This podcast was recorded and produced on the unceded land of the Wurundjeri Woiwurrung people of the Kulin Nation. We pay our respects to the people of the Kulin Nation and all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander elders, past and present.
This is the First Time Podcast.
It's us talking writing and publishing.
Welcome to our Masters series,
where we interview Australian and international authors at the top of their games.
I'm Kate Mildenhall.
And I'm Catherine Collette. Welcome to the First Time Podcast.
Masters Series.
We're in the depths of school holidays.
Can you tell by the extra wrinkles?
Oh my God. There's like, I was going to say, have you gotten any writing done? But I'm going to pair that back to... What does creativity look like?
Do you know,
of school holidays?
That's a really good question, because I actually took very much to heart before the start of these holidays what so many people have suggested to us in the past, which is you don't get any work done in the school holidays if you don't have care for your children and you are the person who normally is present in the home. But I actually did have lots of days sorted. For other people to be the person who is in the place of taking the care of the children, and instead just had some big fun days with many children in my care, which has been really nice. So in fact, I would argue that my creativity mostly has come from doing big fun days with the kids.
Yeah, very nice. You know? Very nice.
Yeah.
Yep.
I didn't get to see the ocean though. Have you seen the ocean this
school
holidays?
I've seen the ocean. We went to Inverloch for the first week. I was up and back with work. But I tell you what, one of the best investments of all time is full-length wetsuits for everyone in our family. Honestly. So we were in the water every day. There's no way I would ever get in the water in winter or spring, allegedly spring in Victoria. But with a wetsuit, it's so doable. So every day we went for long swims in the ocean, bodyboarding, boogie boarding, whichever you prefer to call it. It was so good. It was really fun.
That's brilliant. That makes me feel good on your behalf. We did trees. I went forest, deep on forest this holidays because I couldn't get to the ocean. And we did. Have you gone to the Redwood Forest near Warburton?
No.
It's so pleasing. Like, it's really delightful to be in. I'd seen lots of people.
What is
pictures.
There? It's an
old plantation. Yeah. So you can just, but you just kind of wander in it. We got there before all the Instagrammers get there. But
is there a time that the Instagrammers is it golden
what
hour?
You can tell, I don't know, it's very dark in there amid the trees, but you can tell by, you know, those places that you can tell you've got there at a good time because you pull up and you actually get a park in the parking area. Yes. And then you see that all of the roads leading in have no standing signs along the sides and you go, oh, okay. I see how this is super duper popular. But it was just really lovely being around such big trees.
Yeah.
And we did the,
it is very calming.
Also the Rainforest Gallery near Warburton, where you kind of go out over the top. There's just this little platform that you can go out and look out over the forest and then, go down kind of by the creek and the ferns and truly, truly delightful. And then treetops in Belgrave, that kind of big obstacle coursey thing where you're way up in the sky.
People rave about that. That does not fall within my definition of fun. Is it fun?
It was so fun. It was so fun partly because...
Are you on zip lines? Are you like...
Yeah.
Are you flying foxing?
Yeah, in some places and other places, you know, so you're zip lining or you're climbing or you're doing other things. But you know that bit where you like get given the keys to the kingdom, like you're like, they shouldn't really be letting us do that.
Oh,
like, I'm
God.
Up here with kids. Why are they letting us hook ourselves on and off? And this is really quite high risk, but high risk, high reward. Like, so much fun. So much fun. I couldn't go up to the big, very high ones, the black course, because the kids I was with were too young. But I totally want to go back and do the higher course.
Oh, I feel that way with that clipping on, clipping off, even at Go Climb, like at the kids' play centre. Like,
it's so true.
Oscar had a party there. I think I was the only parent that was like, okay, calm down. Too high.
You're about to fall.
Horrendous. Oh, torturous for all involved. Yeah.
So have you got writing done? Because you're also in that strange, murky space between projects.
No writing. It's such a funny space, isn't it? It's
how are you feeling?
Come at starting something new. Well, I think what has been my salvation is the artist's way.
Mm-hmm.
It's a really good, it's great for the time between books because you feel like you're nourishing creativity without necessarily doing things that need to have an outcome. Examples.
Yes.
Artist's date. So morning pages is like a key part of it, but then the artist dates, which kind of fall behind, I think, in normal life. So I've managed two these holidays. One, and I think artist dates are hard to come up with ideas for. One was to a cemetery.
Oh,
it's a good one. It is technically the cemetery that my dad is buried in. So it sort of was both a date and a visit.
Nice.
But I was very slow paced and it was sort of, I feel like it fell in both categories. It was a good place to visit, very nice to wander around looking at old graves.
Mm.
And the other was Fitzroy Library to just sit for an hour and read magazines on a comfy chair by a window, which is such a thing I used to do as a kid all the time. I would always go to the library, not to read magazines, to read books. But I would sit happily I'd bounce my basketball down. There was a ring nearby and then I'd go to the library. It's really nice.
That is lovely. So is that something that you can do? Can you do that more? Can you build this reading time at the library into your week?
I don't know that I would. I think I think the pausing element of artists or of the artist's way is really nice in that it does make you stop and do certain things. Whether I would spend an hour in the library, maybe. I'd probably look for something different to do, you know, something different to stumble upon. But it was really nice.
Where do you normally get your reading done? Are you like an in-bed only reader or do you have a special chair?
I don't have a special chair, the couch or in bed. We're limited on spaces. I often think I should get a chair in the study that is like a comfy chair.
So the couch once everyone's gone to bed or once the children have gone to
bed? No, people will be around. That's the trouble with the couch.
Yeah.
But if I'm really into a book, I'm sure you're the same. You read it in snatches, you know, while the kettle is boiling, I'll be standing reading the.
Yeah.
Yeah. I remember you saying that about Tegan Bennett Daylight to get off her phone. She had books everywhere.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think that is such a great concept.
Yeah. Just in random spots. I think so too. Okay. Last night you got to go to a function that I failed to make it to because of the general holiday, school holiday extravaganza and multiple children. Can you please tell us where you went and who was there and how much fun you had? So I can.
It was so good. Petronella McGovern, who's not normally based in Melbourne, she's a Sydney-based author, came to Melbourne for one event only. It was at Brighton Library on the other side of town.
Very much the other side of town. That was part of the difficulty.
It's a big trek. It was great. There was lots and lots of people there, and there were lots of authors and writers and Melbourne writing community people there. Sally Hepworth was there. Kylie Ladd, Kylie Orr, Fiona Taylor. It was just had such a nice vibe. And it is so much that thing, which I'm sure we keep saying, but having been through the pandemic for such a long time and experiencing book events through the lens of a screen to be in real life was pretty special. And they also, which feels very pre-pandemic, had wine.
What? Wine and
a lot. I'm so surprised.
Oh my gosh,
when
I love it.
A library is doing, free drinks. So,
that's brilliant.
It was very, very fun.
I am halfway through reading The Liars at the moment, and it is one of those ones that I am leaving in various places around so that I can quickly get in another chapter before I have to go and do the next thing. It's very good.
Yeah, it was good hearing her talk about it, actually. I like hearing where people's ideas have come from and how their thinking evolves and that thing of what two things they put together, like seemingly disparate elements.
Yes.
You know, they're not intuitive, but you can see also why they do come together.
Once
pointed out to you.
I have just talked about that at length with a guest who is coming up on the show in the next few weeks, Holly Ringland, about The Seven Skins of Esther Wilding, which is her new book, which is what I have been reading. And that has got what feels like all these disparate things, fairy tales and swans and seals and tattoos and particular types of cakes, all the astronomy, all these different things, and the way that she pulls them together is really extraordinary. So that's a really fun conversation. And you can imagine Holly and I at both of our levels of kind of extroversion and madness and chaos in talking to each other. It was quite a funny one to just be editing as well. So that is coming up soon, but I highly recommend that book. That is one that I read very quickly.
There was a good article on Lit Hub actually on that idea of disparate things, where the author, I think it was Alison Wisdom, who's written a book called The Burning Season, which I haven't read, but The Burning Season features a woman who ends up in a cult. And so Alison has written this article that looks at cults and gymnastics. So her daughter is a gymnast. But it's such an interesting, the level of discipline required within gymnastics, the level of, she talks about the way that her daughter, who is a, I think, a pretty accomplished kind of gymnast, though she's fairly young, would, I don't know, do tricks or whatever they're called, routines, and would sort of turn to the coach, and the coach would be the one that said, yeah, that was good, or that was not good, that you sort of lose your sense of your internal sense of that was good.
That's,
you
know, very that interesting.
Sort of this outward looking. Anyway, it was a really just an interesting putting together of two things. But then she also spoke about how then once she had noticed this sort of similarity between these two things, one of the main characters in the book, or the main character that joins this cult, she then made her a former gymnast.
Yeah.
Sort of this nice way in which you kind of see similarities in things and they become absorbed into your work.
Yeah, and also because when you notice them in real life, right, like I think that that's the odd thing in both talking to Holly about her work and also the conversation that I had with Margot Lanigan about how things end up fitting in to your work and how weird we actually are in real life, like all that stuff that is stranger than fiction. Like, of course they're a former gymnast, or how much yes. detail you need to kind of make backstories when you're writing. And how often it's the weird stuff that has a real buzz about it when you end up putting it in, or that you need to look out for. Do I sound like a woman who's deep in drafting and looking at my work like, what a mess I have just made? Anyway, carry
on.
It's
part of the process. It's part of the process.
God, I hate the process, Catherine. Can't the process just be finished already?
It's sort of, yeah, I know, it's excruciating and wonderful at the same time. The artist's way, not to sound like an evangelist, but
talking about cults.
Yeah. She also talks, so you have these questions that you do each week. I'm not as into the questions, but they are useful. But she also often, there'll be a question around how did you notice synchronicity this week? That sort of to be on the lookout for that. I really like that as a question.
Yeah. I did a lecture for RMIT this week on research, and I was talking about a bunch of stuff, some of which I'm looking at for the PhD. And there's this really cool idea, and I'm not going to be able to pronounce the names of the people who do it, but it's about serendipitous research. And it really goes to that idea of what Charlotte talks about looking for heat, or when an idea feels like a magnet and everything, or, you know, you see something three times. And this idea of in this particular idea, I will find a link and put it in the show notes about people who do serendipitous kind of research where they're looking for synchronicity. There's a type of researcher called a super encounterer, and they're one who is like just really flexible and open with the questions they're asking and really receptive to the new stuff that's kind of coming in and bouncing off their brain. And I'm really into that idea that you can be a super encounterer because you just, you've got your feelers out for all that weird stuff, and you're paying attention to, oh, wow, that's the third time I've heard about, I don't know, the seed vault in Svalbard or whatever. There must be something in that I'm super interested in. I like that idea.
Academics have names for everything.
They really do. They really do have names for everything. And you know what is hard being a baby academic? When you don't know the names for anything and you spend a lot of time in WhatsApps going, you know that feeling or that theory about where words come from, what's that called? Anyway, tell me.
Some moments I'm jealous of the academic life. Other moments I'm not jealous of the academic life.
Don't be.
There was a good Twitter thing, though. Recently someone was talking about, it was an academic, and they were running a course on teaching people how to read academic articles in this sort of vein of, you're not meant to read every word. Like when professors or whoever is lecturing gives you all of these readings to read, the intent is never that you would read every word in every article, that a lot of it is about honing this skill of getting the gist. Mm-hmm. I wonder what you think of that. I mean, that's how most people survived undergrad, but.
Yeah. oh, I'm very much a get the gister. And like, look at these piles of books around me. Like they are, I get the gist of, you know, generally a lot of those, I'm just about getting the gist. And also let's remember that I'm a speed reader. And so sometimes whatever book I read, I feel like at the end of it, I merely got the gist of it.
Yes.
And also,
but that's a cruel thing about a great book sometimes, like a great book that has enough tension that is propelling you. I just want to know what happens. Like I'm loving it, but I'm also like desperate to.
Yeah.
It's such a tension of enjoyment.
Cut the description. I don't want to hear about the lake.
I want to know what happens.
I don't want to hear about the marshes. All right. Let's not talk any more about the marshlands.
That's right. No more marshlands.
Let's just find out who killed who. So have you been skimming or getting the gist of any books? Have you been reading deeply?
I've been reading, well, this book I read word for word. It is Time and Tide in Sarajevo by Bronwyn Birdsall. I know that you have read this. Okay. It's really good. It's a literary book. It does not feature any marshes. It is very, very compellingly.
It is.
It's got thriller vibes. But you can also see the love with which each sentence, and I really mean each sentence, is constructed. Yeah. It's excellent. I knew nothing about Sarajevo beforehand. It's set in the aftermath, multiple years after the Bosnian War. So you have this kind of echo of that within it. But I think what's really beautiful about it is that Bronwyn, who also, like the protagonist Evelyn, taught English for a number of years in Sarajevo, comes at it as both an insider and an outsider. Mm.
Yeah.
So she's an outsider because she's not Bosnian. She's an Australian-born woman. Is Bronwyn Australian-born? Anyway, she's not Bosnian.
Yeah.
So she's an outsider in that sense, but she spent enough time there that she has also this insider insight as well.
Yeah.
And that's such a unique space to be able to sit in. So
yeah,
highly recommend.
I concur with everything you said. And I also, what you said about each of her sentences and having written it with such love, I think that that is also the care that she has for the experience she's had and for the research she's done. You can really tell that in there as well. There's very, very beautifully done. And as we have discussed already, she also has an excellent website. So you should all go and check that out and click through on the links to buy her book. I nearly picked you up a Maeve Binchy in their local.
Oh, did you?
Our local library. Which one? What are they called? Our little free library the other day.
Oh, you should have. I didn't know that they even have them in our libraries.
Okay. All right. I'll go down and send you a picture of what the title is if it's still there. You very possibly already read it.
Hilarious. I know. I feel a bit shamed about that, but anyway.
No, there's no shame.
It's a bit lowbrow.
No, it's not lowbrow at all. I'm still doing these, looking for these stupid diary entries. Maybe that's what's making me feel so at sea today. And I found one of my library lists, which included two Maeve Binchys on it. So,
from
there's no judgment from me. Oh, like during my teen years? No judgment here. No judgment at all. What else have you been reading?
The other one I wanted to mention is Lee Kaufman's The Rider Laid Bare, which I know you've spoken to as well. It is 100% as good as everybody says it is. Belated endorsement. It is. Are you talking about the being in that more difficult space of writing sometimes where you're just like, what am I even doing? And she talks about that experience in there. And it's she has such a comforting and loving way of writing. She's so unflinchingly honest. I think Lee Kaufman is an incredible writer, and there's so much of her in this writing book. I really recommend it.
Mm. And I think too, she's been doing some really great workshops and courses and events about it. So I think people should really get along to those too, because she is exactly like how she comes across in the book in person as well, if not more warm and loving and generous.
She is also, like, if you are a nonfiction, particularly if you're a nonfiction writer, she's a great person to get mentoring from. Really,
said that
really
before.
Good. I've done that. Yeah, she's excellent. What have you been reading?
Well, The Liars is obviously what I'm not being able to put down right now. But the other one that I've read is a debut collection of short fiction called Cautionary Tales for Excitable Girls.
Oh, this is on my bedside table. It's top of the to be read.
Oh, I think you will really like it. So it's from a debut writer, Anne Casey Hardy, and it is just one of those collections where you think she has just nailed this experience of kind of young girlhood of teenage years, of early motherhood. Like, she's just nailed the experiences. And I got to talk to her. She is our featured author this week. Today, our featured book segment is brought to you by Scribner, and we're delighted to be talking to Anne Casey Hardy about her new collection of stories, Cautionary Tales for Excitable Girls. Anne was born in Fremantle and grew up in Melbourne as the eldest of seven children. She won the 2018 Peter Carey Short Story Award, was shortlisted for the 2019 VU Overland Short Story Prize, and was awarded a 2021 Varuna Residential Fellowship. Her short stories and poetry have been published in Mianjin, Island Magazine, Overland, Westerly, and several anthologies. Anne has previously worked as a research librarian and as an advocate for families of premature babies, and her work in this area has been published in various medical journals. She lives with her husband in Melbourne's West on Bunurong land. Welcome, Anne.
Thank you, Kate. I'm really pleased to be here.
Congratulations on this fabulous debut collection. It really has a who's who of endorsements from Auslit luminaries like Charlotte Wood, Tegan Bennett Daylight, Tony Birch, to name a few. And they've described the collection variously as blackly funny, haunting, original, unforgettable. How do you describe your collection of cautionary tales for excitable girls? What's your pitch?
It's pretty much in the title. It's the tension between, you know, wanting to go into the world and go after what it is you hope for and long for, tempered against all of the messages we get growing up as a girl. You know, don't go here, don't go there, wear this, don't wear that, smile but not too much, and so on. And just that incredible tension of being young and just wanting to break through all that and just feel the world, you know, in the fullest possible way.
It certainly, as a reader, conjured those feelings up for me. You've got fairy tales, myths, girlhood to motherhood, the bliss and kind of nightmare as well of domesticity. And multiple times as I read them, I was transported to moments from my own life, kind of schoolies week around a campfire, those long, very long, impossibly long dark nights when you've got a new baby, the distraction kind of desire. Has the life matter, this kind of material that you keep coming back to, has that changed over time as you've been writing?
The life matter that I persistently come back to is just the exhilaration and desire to explore the world, balanced against fear and risk and all the warnings. As a very young child, I have a strong memory of trying to make a book out of nursery rhymes. There would be, like, I had a problem because I couldn't spell the word rhymes, and I've never forgotten that, and I've always been able to spell it since. With the nursery rhymes on one side and illustrations on the other side. But I remember, even like, I think it might have been six, the quandary of how to draw the nursery rhyme, because they almost always ended in some kind of disaster or catastrophe that felt capricious. And the same with fairy tales, which I absolutely loved and read for years. So many of the endings were, there was so much cruelty involved, and so much, like, the ending almost seemed to be like, don't do it, whatever you're thinking, just don't do it. Don't let down your hair. Don't look in the mirror. Don't question. The Greek myths too, I come back to those. They are just so enthralling and beautiful. It was just life-changing for me to imagine such a big, bright, strange world that wasn't Catholic and wasn't full of all the rules that we had in our little suburb in Faulkner. But it was more like there were no rules because the gods were so capricious. All the heroes were male. And there seemed to be like a huge penalty for being female. You'd get turned into a tree or a swan or a toad or a sea monster or, you know, Medusa. And the penalties for rejecting male advances were, you know, basically annihilation. And rape was normalized. So it's incredible to, as you know, as a woman growing up, absorbing all those things that, you know, this is how life is, no matter how you approach it, via reality or via myth or via fairy tales. There's still so many things that women shouldn't do, but want to. I always wanted to. I acting impulsively and breaking rules was just something I did compulsively once I was 14 or 15. It's a bit ironic, but if there hadn't been so many rules and warnings, I probably would have been more careful.
I want to ask you a little bit about how you came to put the collection together. You've won a number of awards and been published over time. When did you find a publisher? How did that come to be, Anne?
Well, for a long time I was writing a novel, and the stories were just something I did now and again to break it up. The real turning point for me was when I read Tegan Bennett Daylight's Six Bedrooms, and something about the cover, which is a teenage girl climbing through a window, just caused a really powerful reaction in me. And I just had this feeling that inside me were stories that could climb out a window if I made the space for them. But I kept writing the novel until I read that Tegan was doing a short story focus week at Verona, and I really wanted to go to meet her. I just felt like there was a connection there and something I wanted to pursue. So I did that, and, you know, she was wonderful and understood me, you know, in a way it hadn't happened before. And during that week I wrote Being the Mother, which was my first short story, and Birds. So both of those happened in the same week, and both of them won prizes. It was almost like the stories had been waiting while I occupied myself with something busy, and then were born in the right circumstances.
You had these moments of stories being quite successful and being published. Did you have publishers or editors reaching out to you to say, you know, Anne, have you got a collection? Or did you have to wait until you had a whole lot of those stories together to pitch that?
Well, there was quite a bit of interest after the Peter Carey, I think, because I had no history, no publication history, and I had such a strong voice. So I did have a publisher approach me wanting to read the novel, but the novel, it wasn't ready, and it also wasn't very good, and I knew both those things. So that was a situation that was really pressured, where I felt like I had to, you know, I had to do it. So that didn't work out very well in the long term. After that, I kept wanting to be finished with the novel, so I was really keen to find someone who would look at it. When I finally got up to a good draft of it, I got an agent. Well, I got two agents, which was pretty amazing. Both of them liked the novel. And I signed with Gabby Nahr from Left Bank Literary. She's absolutely beautiful. But that was March 2020, just when it was the wrong time to be going out into the world with a novel that, you know, was never guaranteed on any level, you know. And she tried really hard to sell it. But while that was happening, because the novel was somewhere and doing what it was supposed to do, I wrote short stories and I worked really hard. I virtually committed 24/7 to writing one short story a month.
Wow. That's incredible discipline. And do you, as you're writing them, Anne, do you just stay in the world of one and then write it through, complete it, and then move on to the next?
Yeah, I'm completely sequential about everything. That's how my brain works. So when I say write one short story a month, maybe three of those days would be writing. Mm-hmm. The rest of the time would be like despairing and, you know.
All the normal writer feelings.
Up and down. But it was because each story had to be created anew. There was never going back to work on a story again or picking up where you left off. It would take all this agitation. Then I would feel that I had something there, and then I would sit down and write. The rest of the time I would be writing too, but it just was never the feeling of flow that came with writing it. Most of my short stories take about a week, and the rest of the time I still have to focus 24/7 on getting there, but it's not really visible.
Mm. So by the end of, well, not that we are at the end of the pandemic, but by the end of all of those interminable kind of months of writing, you had a collection that you were then able to give to your agent.
Yes. Well, I always hoped that the collection, I always planned that the short story collection would be my follow-up. You know, I wanted to be ready if anyone was interested in the novel. But I realised that the stories are just more alive and more original, you know.
I wanted to ask specifically about endings, because I know it's something that writers talk about all the time, and it strikes me that short story writers have much better practice at landing endings than novelists do, because they only have to do it a couple of times. Whereas you as a short story writer do it all the time. Some of the stories in this collection have a real sting in the tale. Others end quite abruptly. And there were a couple of times when I felt like I was kind of out of breath or gasping at the end. Can you tell us a little bit about how you know where to end a story and how you make sure you've landed it well?
It's really interesting. And I'm happy to talk about it because I think it's one of the things I'm good at, or I feel like I'm good at. I always know without a doubt when I've got the voice, that's when I know I've got the story. And it's a feeling of certainty. And I feel the same way about the ending. I might be writing towards the ending, but when I write the sentence, which is the last sentence, there's a complete feeling that I know it's the last sentence. Sometimes I'll go back and write more before the last sentence, but I know the last sentence when it hits. And it's not always, you know, like a complete resolution. I know that other people have said that. And in the layout of the Scribner stories, if they end right at the bottom of the page, I know people are going to turn the page and be absolutely horrified that there isn't at least a few more sentences. I'd rather they went over the page and you could see ahead of the shock, you know, that they were ending. I've been interested in endings, and Tegan was wonderful. She said that the ending should tell you what the short story's about. Mm-hmm. And I've heard other theories of short story endings. But for me, it ends when there's enough of a finality that the story will echo afterwards. I want the story to continue in the reader's imagination after I've finished it. So it's an instinct for what makes a really strong sentence. And then that feeling of resonance that comes afterwards.
Like many other writer readers, I love reading acknowledgements, and I went straight to yours.
Oh, good.
And seeing the kind of ecosystem of support, I think, that a writer acknowledges when they get to the end of their work. Who or what have been the most significant supports in this writing life for you, Anne?
Well, for a very long time, I wrote on my own. And like you, I always read acknowledgements. And often really jealously. And I just think, imagine what it would be like to have so many people who cared about what you write. I got the Varuna Fellowship on the basis of the short story collection. And it was the third time I applied. But it just worked like beautiful magic that I could go there and not only be at Varuna, but also be in contact with Tegan, and she could do the final assessment of my stories. That's where it all came together. But it's like a glacier, you know, so much is under the surface. That was just where it came together. And that's after 7 years of writing. But when it came together, I could really feel it. It's just, it never happened for me by coincidence or without a lot of agitation.
Can you tell us the best or the worst, if you want to, but you've been good so far at giving us the best advice that you have been given about writing, Anne?
I did a really great retreat with Charlotte Wood, and virtually everything she said was helpful, which is a lot of it's in The Luminous Solution. But one thing that stuck with me was she said, work with a 5% improvement, you know, so go to your work and go over it. And if you can only fix it by a few words, it's worth it. You just have to come back and do it lots of times. But the whole idea of a 5% improvement and not a massive rewrite was really helpful to me. And the other thing I'd like to say that Tegan advised me, she doesn't like me going into very dark places. She's the person who made me return the baby at the end of being the mother. She said, you cannot have them falling asleep on the train and the baby not, you know, somewhere safe. But she said, write joyfully. She told me to write joyfully, which I understand to be the energy in the story and exhilaration of the characters. But it presented a really interesting complexity to me because I wanted to write about, you know, scary things. Mm. I wanted to write about my own fears. And then to approach those fears and be able to still write joyfully about them, that's been a great elevation in my writing.
Can you please recommend a debut book, any time and any genre?
I have some Australian debuts, which I would love to recommend. Ashley Goldberg's Abomination. I love that book because I know so little about Jewish religion. Grew up Catholic, and it, you know, when one of the characters in his book says, "What's a Pope?" I laughed so much I wept. And I thought, imagine being in a world where you can say, "What's a Pope?" Also really loved Mary Rose's Coscelli's The Cane.
Yes.
I love that because the atmosphere is so dense, and atmosphere is something I'm really interested in. But last night when I got the word that you were looking for a debut novel from any time or place, not just Australian recent debuts, I thought of The Confessions of Franny Langton. Have you ever read that book?
I have not.
The Confessions of Franny Langton. It's by a woman called Sarah Collins. And it's set in Jamaica on a sugar plantation in the 18th century. And then it goes to London. So it has a lot of echoes of Jane Eyre and The White Sargasso Sea. But the heroine is a black woman, a slave, or a freeborn son of the, you know, plantation owner, daughter of the plantation owner. Free but not free. And it's also a queer love affair. So it plays with all the whole gothic world that I absolutely love, but from a different approach. And
fantastic.
That was a thrilling book.
I love adding new ones to our list.
Thank you.
And where can people catch you talking about your incredible collection, Cautionary Tales for Excitable Girls?
Well, I'm open to all invitations for a start.
Excellent.
But I am on the program for the Blue Mountain Writers Festival. On the 23rd of October, I'm doing a session with Tegan Bennett-Daylight and Evelyn Conlon from Ireland. And I think that'll be really fun. And come there for a holiday because it's just so beautiful.
It's such a beautiful part of the world. And Casey Hardy, it's been such a pleasure to speak with you and to read your incredible collection, Cautionary Tales for Excitable Girls, which I encourage our listeners to get out and get a copy of. I look forward to seeing what comes next, Anne, and to reading your new work.
Thank you so much, Kate.
Okay, so my current favorite podcast is a podcast called Unfuck Your Brain. Ooh. It's very Ben Crowe, who's the well-known mindset coach. Everyone talks about him as being Ash Barty's mindset coach.
Yeah.
He has other clients as well. So it's very in a him vein. The host is Cara Lowenthal. Lowenthal. Anyway, she basically describes her own podcast as sort of sitting in this nexus between psychology and feminism. But it's a coaching, it's essentially a life coaching podcast. The irony of this is not lost on me, that within my own work, I have satirized life coaches. And now I feel like I'm obsessively listening to multiple life coaches. It's just really, really good. It's in that Ben Crowe vein of, you know, this thing of having goals and wanting to achieve things, but also realizing that your happiness and your sense of self can't be contingent on achievement and achieving those things. So Ben Crowe would kind of talk about an elite athlete who wins Wimbledon and then at that point has to sort of, you know, has all that success and then has to work out who he was, who they are. Whereas really the way to do it is to work it out along the way. Anyway, Cara Lowenthal, Unfuck Your Brain. It's really good for, I think it's really good for creatives. Particularly women, because it has this feminist vantage. What that feminist vantage looks like from a coaching point of view, for example, is things like coaching should be non-hierarchical. You know, some of these sort of ideas like that. But I'm getting so much out of it. I just drive around. It's a lot of thought work. I think she also has a club that you can pay for. It's called The Clutch. They have intakes periodically. I'm not part of that. But I really recommend it, particularly in this space, I think, and we had some discussion of this in the previous podcast that we ended up taking out for various reasons, but I think writing and selling books in particular can be a really tough gig. Mm-hmm. And I think there's a real sense among many writers at the moment that it's particularly tough right now.
Mm-hmm.
And I think a lot of people who've written a couple of books, you know, that idealistic, I have so many thoughts about it and I don't really know what I think. There's sort of this idealistic world in which we could all be paid to be artists and we could all be paid to write and that would be doable. But it occurs against a backdrop of lots of people wanting to write and maybe readership falling.
Yeah.
So I don't know if that is sustainable. Anyway, it's Unfuck Your Brain. It's a good one to listen to.
I want to know, I have some questions. I want to know, when you get recommended a thing such as that, a new podcast, do you just go back to the top and start listening through, or do you have particular episodes you're like, oh yeah, that looks good to me? What do you do?
Yeah, I'll go, ooh, that looks good.
Okay.
There's another one I'm loath to mention, where she, Cara interviews this, has another life coach that she has on her podcast, and they sort of do a dual discussion. This other woman's name is Corinne Crabtree, and she's incredible. I'm obsessed with her. She's an American, but she's from, I think, Texas. So she's got a real sort of Southern American accent. She swears a lot, but she has her own podcast, but it's a weight loss coaching podcast. But she's wonderful to listen to. I'm not interested in weight loss, but you could, like, there's no meal plan. It's all about the head game in her context of weight loss. Apparently a lot of life coaches do work around weight loss, but you could pretty much just pull out the words weight loss, goal weight, and put creative goals, because it's so much about the way that you talk to her, the way that you talk to yourself, and this kind of Ben Crow idea of achievement and, you know, and worth being not contingent on achievement. Anyway, hers is called, what is it? Corinne Crabtree, Losing 100 Pounds with Corinne Crabtree. I'm not recommending it from a weight loss perspective, but the thought work in both of these podcasts, and that's sort of what they talk about in this particular episode, and I'll link in show notes.
Please do link, because, you know, I had a moment of, in preparing for the retreat that I'm about to do, of going like, I need a session with a mindset coach just to get my head around what I'm attempting to do in the period of time that I'm away, and how devastated I'll feel if I don't meet, you know, the goal that I'm setting for myself and the pressure that I'm putting myself.
They would have great coaching on this. But I do think there is a void around, there's a lot of mentoring on offer. And the distinction I see between mentoring and coaching in this sort of way is that mentoring is really project specific, whereas I think coaching is much more about the person more than the things that they're working on at any one time. I think there's a real gap around it. And it keeps reminding me of, there was this one housewife on Beverly Hills Housewives, Teddy Mellencamp, who came on as an accountability coach, also around weight. But she would basically, women would, to the point of, I mean, she has a very big program now, but women would, on the show, they, you know, one of her clients would send her a photo of a menu at a restaurant and be like, what should I order? And so Teddy would be like, oh, order this thing or order that thing. But I think there's this space, and that's to an extent, but I do think there's this space in the creative world where it would be great to be coached, like, all about mindset. This is what you're working on this week.
Yes.
That would be really cool to have. So in the absence of that,
I'm going to listen to all of your, I'm going to listen to all of these podcasts. That's really excellent. Really excellent. And just picking up too on what you said about, the general kind of doldrums of what it looks like we are in at the moment. And it will be interesting to see all the data that's coming out, as well as what we're collecting anecdotally. The thing that they're doing in Ireland, the test run that they're doing in Ireland, where they're paying a living wage to artists. I mean, I don't think they're paying every artist. I think it's a test run. I'll put a link in there to the article. But I have also just seen so many people, so many Australians linking to it and sharing it on socials.
I haven't seen that. That's incredible.
This is what we need, just to know that someone is actually saying and validating that we need you and your arts, that you are a functioning part of our society and what we think that it is. And you also deserve a living wage.
Did you say Ireland or Iceland?
Ireland. Although,
yeah, right.
Iceland's probably been doing it for 20 years. You know, they tend to do those things. But yeah, Ireland.
I feel like Ireland does value writing. Yeah. I mean, that suggests that they do. But
yeah, maybe we should all move there. I want to tell you that finally, for people who've been following along with my Stranger Things journey, I have finished season 4. Etta and I have spent some of our holiday time together watching the final few episodes, and without spoilers, because I know that there'll be other Stranger Things fans out there. And Catherine, I know that you haven't watched it, but very extraordinarily in TV world, the last two episodes were both about 2 hours long. And I'm pretty sure that as they released them, they kind of released them together. So it was this massive kind of
4 hours
length. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. So we watched them separately, but like the finale was everything that you want from a finale, like the tenseness, the tears, the joy, the excitement that, oh my God, things cannot possibly get higher stakes right now. Like this is just kind of beyond
wonderful.
It is. And like, I went back this morning to look at some of the reviews and the analysis and stuff. And let me say straight up to Stranger Things fans out there, you know, I am not part of the whole fandom. I do not understand everything that you lot understand. I'm not a D&D person. I don't understand all the genre, etc. But in terms of just the pure entertainment factor of what this series has provided me, one of the Guardian articles this morning just said something about the impeccable judgment of what they'd included in the finale. And that was it. From a storytelling entertainment perspective, to go, oh, you have absolutely nailed that. Of course that, you know, storyline came
out. Inevitable but surprising.
Yes. Like, inevitable but surprising. And that bit, you know, when you've got like multiple settings in a book or in a series and you've got the fade out and you go, I do not know which storyline they're going to take me to next because everything is so pressing. But
oh my God. All right. I have to watch it.
I think you have to go back to the start. Yeah. You have to go to the start of season.
Does it not? Series are not standalone. I guess series are.
They're not really. You don't get, I would suggest that you wouldn't get the satisfaction and payoff if you haven't watched from season one. But I was thinking about it from how satisfying it was for me as a viewer, but also about the fun that I reckon the writers had in writing it, because you can tell they've got obviously their in-jokes with their own material and their in-jokes with the stuff they're referencing and how kind of over-the-top explosive and the rest of it that it was. And it made me think of something that we put up as a quote, but that Margot Lanigan said, where she was talking about she's not a planner, she's a pantser, but there's this idea of, you know, she knows kind of this thing will happen and then something else will happen. And then she described it as a wobbly wasteland in the middle, where she's not sure how things will happen. But the question she asks herself is, what would be the most fun way to get there? And I was like, that's what you can feel in those series that really buzz, or in those books that even when they are dark or they cover dark material, you know that the author has joy in it, right?
They're can feel it on the page, can't you? It just, whether it's like joy or a sense of humor, but you can see.
Yeah.
It's not buzzing. Completely bleak. Yeah.
Yeah. They were buzzing when they delivered it. So I think just on that absolute kind of story knowledge as well, I was trying to explain it to Etta. I'm like, see, this is the bit where all is lost. You know how you feel like all is lost? Because she's like, Mom, what's going to happen? And I'm like, but it's not, is it? All is not lost. Like they've always got something they're going to pull out of their bag. And just that feeling of understanding how you might then turn to your manuscript, which appears to be dying on this page in front of you, and go, okay, well, let's think about how I can bring back the fun. Like, that sense of fun for myself. So, so that is me. I'm still, obviously no one came through with any kind of link to put us in touch with the Duffer brothers, but I will persist. I will persist.
That's a massive endorsement. I'm very excited about that.
Yeah,
that makes me feel like the watching would be, do you remember being a kid watching something that was really exciting and you would like be squirming and half running in the chair? And
yes, like, that's exactly
cool feeling.
That my watch told me that my heart rate was up like on numerous occasions. I think it's when it makes you really feel something.
Yeah, it's a great feeling.
Yeah, I did. I know that we were going to ask people last week when we talked about these bad diaries that I have to find, and I put it up on Instagram today where I was like, okay, am I going to choose from 10-year-old, 16-year-old, 19-year-old?
You need to do some examples.
I do need to give some examples. Well, one of the ones that I found today, just talking about the feels that we get as readers and audience members, is when, so I must have been 15 and mum and dad took their long service leave from the teaching profession and we went overseas, and I was very ungrateful 15-year-old because I just wanted to be at home, you know, with going to year nine parties. But I read Vikram Seth, A Suitable Boy. And my diary entry is two pages of scribbles. I remember very clearly that I threw the book across the camping ground that we were in. And when I found the diary entry today, it's, you know, deeply mortifying. And it's just like, I hate this book. I cannot believe he's even done that. And there is one line in there where righteous 15-year-old Kate also says, Vikram Seth has clearly never even been in love because he does not understand that they would not marry each other. So that's the kind of bad diaries that I am dealing with.
That.
But it was, I could see it. I could see it in my scribbled handwriting. There were tears. I've circled them as one did when they were 15 years and you cried into your diary and then circled the tears to like show the proof of how deeply upset you were. And might I add that there's no such kind of crazy feelings about other humans or anything else happening in the world. Only books. It's only like I was brutally shaped and formed by the books that I read as a young person. We'll just leave it at that.
They need another word for it, kind of like milestone, but that marriage of like remembering a place where you read a book.
Yes.
And how the memories of reality merge with the imagined world. Yeah.
There is someone, and I will not be able to remember this because my brain just keeps getting more civil-like every day, but she records her books. Maybe it's an author. She records her books only by place. So she's got a little black book of them and she just records the place that she was and the book that she read. No other notes. I'm like, that's a cool way to do it.
Wow.
If you had, yeah. Maybe if you traveled a bit more, it would be kind of more indicative, but yeah.
You kind of, it would be good not to have a book, but to have a map.
A map.
Mark them on the map. Yeah, would be better.
That's nice. I like that. Okay, that's what. So, anything has the summer season in?
No, I'm waiting for Real Housewives of Beverly Hills tonight. But I have watched a non-reality show, and hearing you talk about Stranger Things reminds me of how I was feeling. Just that squirminess of watching Bad Sister, which is on Apple TV. It's about a group of sisters. It begins with a funeral. This one
of the sisters. It's got Sharon Horgan in it. Is that her name?
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, my God, she's so good. I love her.
Amazing. Well, the collection of sisters are all amazing. So the husband of one sister has died. He's awful. Like, we get the sense that he's awful. And, in fact, that would really be my only critique of the show.
He's so awful.
They show him as awful in 10 different ways, but you kind of got it in one.
Yeah, right, okay. You know,
maximum two. But it's clear from the start that he has not died from natural causes and that it appears the sisters have killed him. But it's good, but it is so tense. I feel like I am twisting upside down on the couch watching it. It is such a high level of emotion.
Okay.
I really like it, but I can only do an episode at a time. Like, it's hard.
Okay, I'm adding that, and I'm telling you also that you have to – have you watched Catastrophe?
No.
Okay, you've got to watch that. She's in that as well. She wrote that, I think, and that is very, very funny. It's very, very
funny. Oh, funny. Oh, that's good. For some reason, I thought Bad Sister was going to be a dramatic comedy. It is not. It's a thriller.
Oh, it's not. It's not funny at all because she is very funny.
Yeah, no, it's not funny.
Okay.
There's some nice element too among these sisters, but it just is like, whoa.
Okay, all right. Well, I will watch that, and I recommend for you to go and watch Catastrophe, which is where she accidentally, she and another bloke have a one-night stand and they get pregnant, and then it's the series of them. I think they wrote it together. Not sure. Anyway.
Oh, I love it.
Yeah, funny.
Sounds like a less tense watch.
Less tense, yeah. Less tense, definitely less tense. Okay, anything coming up? What is coming up for us? I am doing a online Q&A with Writing New South Wales on Friday the 7th of October. It is free. It is online. All you have to do is register. I'm being interviewed by the amazing Rowena, who works for Writing New South Wales, but we actually did my very first Varuna. She was there. So that'll be really fun to catch up with her.
How nice is that?
Exactly. That is what is coming up. And then obviously I'll just be listening to life coaching things to make sure that I have my shit together before I go.
Be all over it. Honestly, I'm obsessed.
You can find the show notes for today's episode on our website, thefirsttimepodcast.com. Get in touch with us via Instagram or Twitter at @thefirsttimepod, or you can leave us a message on the website. Thanks for listening. You've been listening to The First Time Podcast. We record this podcast virtually on the unceded lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation. We pay our respects to elders, past and present, and we extend that to our First Nations guests and listeners. Sound production by Phoebe 80, who we can employ because of the wonderful support of our patrons via Patreon. Thank you so much for making this podcast possible.